Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, welcome to Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw. That's Briscoe. I'm Bradshaw. And today, whenever you're listening to this or watching this, we've got an incredible guest, one of the Freebirds, Jimmy Jam Garvin. Jimmy Garvin. How you doing, Jimmy?
I'm doing fine, John. It's nice to see you and Jerry, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Hall of Famer, the incredible Hall of Fame speech. I thought we were going to have to send you some oxygen up there. I don't think you've danced quite that long in quite a while.
Yeah, no, it's been quite a while. You're right.
John, I thought I was going to have to go up there and give Jimmy chest compression the way he was dancing up there. And I saw that color of his skin turn blood red. And I said, man, he can't go on much longer. But as long as that other Freebird PS was dancing, Jimmy wasn't going to stop. But, you know, Jimmy's career goes so far back with me, you know, back in the Jimmy, what, late 70s, early 80s, somewhere like that. Tell me the situation. Was Joe Scarpa living in your mom's garage apartment, or how did that all transpire?
Well, thank you, John, for having me. If I didn't thank you yet, and thank you, Jerry, for being here. It's nice to see both of you. I really mean that from the bottom of my heart. And also, since I'm talking about meeting stuff from the bottom of my heart, it's really nice to still be alive, because I shouldn't be. But that is another story. I wrestled at the Sportatorium the first time in 1961, Jerry and John.
How old were you then?
9 years old.
Wow.
Coach John Heath was the coach, and it was the youth program that Eddie Graham had started. Of course, Gordon Solie was there. Gordon Solie interviewed me, I think, when I was 10. So that had been 1962, because we had tournaments all over Florida and stuff. Mike Graham.
Go on, hey, Jimmy, just give me a little roster of the guys, because it was a who's who nowadays of professional wrestling that was in that youth program with Coach John Heath and Don Curtis, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when it first started, of course, Mike Graham, myself, was the first ones there that later that carried on. And then, of course, Bob Orton Jr. was in that program as well. And I can't think of the guy's name right now. But there was about three or four going back that far, you know, 1961. I mean, you know, and then Junior was in there shortly after that. Not, you know, not that far, but, you know, Orton Junior, myself, and Mike, and you know, we had, and the coach John Heath, we had him, but we also had, you know, Don Curtis would step in there sometime, and Coach Joe Scarpa, Carl Gotch. Would do it, and it was quite a program. You asked me about Joe Scarpa in my dad's apartment house in Tampa. You know, Joe Scarpa lived in one of the apartments. It was a main house, and then there was an apartment to the side. There was
one, Ivy Street.
The Ivy Street Castle, right? We used to call it that. And it was to us, it's not there anymore, unfortunately, but a lot of history, and started with Joe Scarpa living there. And that would have been, you know, 1961 when him and his wife moved in there, and I was playing out in the field next door, and he says, "Hey, kid," he says, "you want to come down and see some wrestling?" That's how it started. And I said, sure. He took me down there, and one thing led to another, and I got involved in the camp. But after that, the great Malenko lived there for a while back in the day. As time went on, you know, John Studd lived there, Bruiser Brody lived there, Angelo Mosca lived there, Jake the Snake lived there. Michael Hayes and them almost burn it down. The Freebirds lived there.
Go figure.
They just about almost burn it down. But there was a lot of history there at that place, and we had a good time. You know, Steve Kern had been to the Ivy Street Castle many times. In fact, there's a good story, if you remind me later, I'll tell you about Steve and that story. But that's kind of the, you know, the Sportatorium was, holy smokes, you know, I still have some pictures of, you know, Scarpa and I walking up that alleyway, you know, and coming in there to train, and Charlie lay behind the desk, and all the time. And hand you that.
What time you leaving, Jimmy?
And hand you that little envelope with that little bit of money in it, you know, because they paid like shit.
Yeah.
Okay, they paid like shit.
Wait a minute, I was a partner in that organization.
That's before you came along. It got a lot better after you came along, Gerald.
Thank you, Jimmy.
You're welcome. Hey. But, there's a lot of history there. Holy smokes, right?
Jimmy, I don't want to jump ahead, but we got no format. We got nothing that we're following directly. But one of the biggest thrills of my life, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, was when the first time I got to be in the ring with the Freebirds. You were the iteration of the Freebirds at the time. It's just – I was trying to pinch myself. In fact, I talked to Stone Cold earlier today, and I told you a story before we went on air. Stone Cold told me, he said, one of the first times he got a big push was when he was working with the Freebirds in Atlanta, WCW, and he's going to go over on both of them in some type of handicap match. He's going, I just kind of felt bad. This is the Freebirds. And I said, did you feel bad enough not to go over? And he goes, no, I didn't feel that bad.
I remember working with him in Columbus, Georgia, down there, because I think I was really tired. We'd been up for a while, for whatever reason, but
like a couple decades.
Freebirds have been up for a while. Come on, dude.
Yeah, I know it's a surprise, but you know, and I swear, and Michael was in the corner. And he was glad he was just in the corner. It was a singles match between me and Steve. And Steve was, you know, just young and starting out, and he was rearing to go. And I remember I had to pull it up from everything I had to hang with him. And it hurt so bad, but I'll never forget working with him that night. And we had a hell of a match too, because, you know, I mean, obviously he's a hell of a hand, you know, and having a match with him, you know, not that hard to do at all. But I remember that, God, that was painful. Speaking of painful, and I might bounce around if you don't mind, I was thinking the other day. I was thinking, you know, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm almost figuring out. You know, sometimes we reflect back on what our careers and stuff and what happened and the stuff, and not so much with me nowadays, because I've been with the greatest private airline company in the world. It's not an airline, a private air carrier for 20 years, you know? So, but sometimes I think about, you know, my other great career. I've been blessed to have two great careers. I guess I could say that, you know, I had a great wrestling career, 23 years, and I have a great aviation career. But I was thinking, you know, I wrestled, Danny Hodge, Billy Robinson, Lou Thesz, Buddy Rogers. Did I say him?
No.
I didn't really wrestle him. I got kind of stretched by him, but that's another story. But it was something to think about the history of being in the ring with people like Danny Hodge, you know, and if somebody that never wrestled Danny Hodge wouldn't know too much what I was talking about. But when Danny Hodge would get you in a position that you probably wished you weren't in, his eyes used to look like kind of like a shark's does. They kind of roll back up and all you do is just see the black. Oklahoma City one time, he stretched me, and my gosh, I appreciated it. You know, it's a good lesson, you know, but the fact that to be in the ring with people like Lou Thesz, Danny Hodge, Billy Robinson, Buddy Rogers, I don't know who else that's alive today that's wrestled those guys. You know, it was great.
Jimmy, I was telling somebody the other day about Hodge, having a match with Hodge. You know, you get going, you'd really get flowing, you know. You're working, Hodge would be just as light as a feather. Then all of a sudden, like you said, you'd see that gleam or that click in his eyes. And it was like, especially with me, it was like being a flashback, you know, him, Oklahoma University, me, Oklahoma State University. Hey, kid, this ain't Gallagher Hall, you know. But I think sometimes he'd have those flashbacks where he thought he was back on the amateur mat because the people were so with it, and, you know, come on, Danny, and everything. Oh. I think you'd have to just kind of push the pause button on him and kind of reset, you know.
If you're lucky enough to be able to do that, unfortunately, I think my head was up my ass, so I couldn't push no buttons.
You couldn't hit the pause button.
I couldn't hit a button if I wanted to. But I tell you, another time I was in Dallas, Texas at the Sportatorium with a young gentleman that I think was just coming along. And John, that was you. And I never got such an ass whipping in all my life. To this day.
Tell me about that, Jimmy.
Let me just testify to this. It was ass whipping. He was working, thank God.
He thought he was working.
I thought I was going to have to fight. I knew I couldn't fight for my life. That was over with. I mean, that wasn't even an option, you know?
Now, what year was that, Jimmy?
That was 1984.
And, John, is that when you were just coming along in the business, or had you already been in the business about 10 years?
83.
Actually, early 90s. So Jimmy had just come back in. I think Crockett or somebody was trying to reopen up in the Sportatorium or something. And it really was the biggest thrill of my life. But I was nervous. And I'm just.
Well, hell, you didn't. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Shit.
I'm just waffling these guys. I'll tell you a funny story. So I got Black Bart in the ring one time. I just gotten started. I've been in Japan. I've been wrestling in Japan, you know. So it was, you know how Japan was back then. Almost exclusively in Japan. And that was just, man, they went after young guys, especially young guys who were they thought were a threat. And so I was used to having that almost combat type atmosphere in every match. I come out of the ring one time and a Black Bart had hit me as hard as he could across the forehead with a open fist. And he goes, "That's a receipt, you dumbass." And so I got out of the ring. I told Akbar, I said, "Akbar, he just told me that was a receipt. What does that mean?" And he goes, it means he loves it, kid. Keep doing it. So every time Bart hit me back harder, I thought he's loving it. So I just kept hitting him harder and harder and harder. Bart comes back, throws his stuff everywhere, goes, "I'll never work with that greenhorn idiot again."
What year was that? What year would that have been?
Probably around 91, 92. That's when I first started. I've been to Japan. That's the only place I really wrestled. And it was just, you know, how stiff it was. And I came back and I'm working with Bart, who's one of these, you know, light wrestlers for Bart.
I don't know how I ended up with you in there, but I did somehow. I don't know if I just came back for a show or did something.
You came back for a show with Michael and maybe Bam Bam even. The Von Erichs were back then as well. And it was a kind of a resurgence of the Sportatorium. I just remember being in the ring and when Michael said, because the first time you'd come back, I was in the ring. I don't know who I was in there with, maybe Dick Murdoch or Bobby Duncombe or somebody. And Michael said, "Do you mind giving us the ring?" I said, "Of course not." Man, that place went absolutely ballistic. I mean, people, they talk about Road Warrior pops, you know, we used to always say in the 90s. That Freebird pop in the Sportatorium in Dallas, Texas was quite amazing.
Yeah, they had a lot of history there too. You know, a lot of history. That was '84 when that was going on. That was quite the times. But you know, you go back to Florida a little bit. You know, we had back in Florida in the '70s. I guess it would be Jerry, the middle '70s, late '70s when we had the Leader of the Pack going on.
Right. Yeah. What kind of crew did we have then? I've told John a little bit about this. John, this is a story about that Leader of the Pack T-shirt that we used to all get drunk and pull over on the side of the road and fight each other for and everything. Jimmy, take it from there.
I tell you what, you know, that Leader of the Pack story that I'm going to try to tell and do justice for it. That was the most incredible thing. People that would heard about Florida, you know, championship wrestling from Florida and stuff like that. But the leader of the pack actually became almost more popular than the territory itself as a wrestling territory. It was the territory where the leader of the pack group hung out. It was a notorious group of individuals that could consume an awful lot of beer, tons and tons of beer. And most of them could wrestle pretty good too at times. It depended on the time of night, but I got to tell you one story. Well, like Jerry said, here was the deal. Let me go back so you understand it, and the people watching can understand it. We'd get our beer stocked up, and we'd have a driver, and then on the way back, we would count how many. Plus, let's use Jacksonville to Tampa. That was about a 3.5-hour drive. Depending if he was doing a speed limit or not or whatever. So we count, like, you know, okay, this is 6, this is 8, this is 12. Then, you know, everybody was pretty watched everybody because nobody it was like a bunch of pirates. Nobody trusts nobody in there to count right anyway. So we always made sure we counted. Most of the time kept the empties in a pile. So if there was a discrepancy, we could count the empties, but then it got too full that you couldn't. There's no room. Empties is all in the car. So we had to put that technique aside. So we developed a new technique that if there was a discrepancy in the count, and usually that would happen when you got to about usually around 12 or 15 beers, an hour and a half after you left the arena, there might be a discrepancy where you ask for another one and say, okay, that's 15. And the guy'd say, no, it ain't. That's only 14. No, that's 15. Okay, let's not argue about it. Pull over. Wherever this discrepancy was at, we pulled over. I remember pulling over it by ABC liquor store around the back by the dumpster, had a fight out there with one of them boys. And it was either Gerald or it was Grand Apollo or it was Terry Allen or whoever it was.
Barry Windham.
You'd get out, and we had rules, not too many, but you couldn't punch and hit people in the mouth or nose. It was strictly wrestling, like amateur wrestling, drunk amateur wrestling. So it was takedowns and control. So whoever got control, that was the winner, and whoever won, that's the count that counted. So if Jerry and I, for instance, had a discrepancy, he would always win with me anyway. And so his count would win. And then we'd keep on going. Well, that shirt got bloodied. It got ripped off of people's backs. We took it to a seamstress, actually had her put it back together again, blood stains and all. It's to this day, Jerry has a shirt at his house. And Terry Allen has a Magnum TA, has one, because we needed two. Because it was just unbelievable fights would happen over this. There was another time where Jerry and I think it was Jerry and I. I was off Gun Highway where I lived out there. Jerry, is that where that was?
Yeah. And those shirts, Jimmy Wright, became more valuable than the Florida Heavyweight Championship to the guys.
People were coming into the territory to just try to win the shirt. They would come in and they didn't care about the titles. They didn't care. They wanted to go on a road trip and for the leader of the pack and try to compete and take that shirt. Because if you took if you won the shirt, you had to defend it every night. And we wrestled every night. So it didn't matter. It didn't matter if you had 24 beers the night before. You had to defend it the next night, no matter what. So this night we come home to my house and we had discrepancy right in front of my house, and I had a nice yard just put in and everything. Man, I don't know. It didn't turn out probably that good for me, I don't think, but I got up the next morning to, you know, go get the paper. Well, and it probably wasn't morning either. It was probably right around 1 p.m. When I came to, but I staggered out to the yard. Well, there was a circle in the yard that was about 20 feet in diameter, and it was all dirt. We had a wrestling match out there, And my wife told me the story, you know, that she says, yeah, y'all was out there, you know, wrestling in the yard. And we tore up every blade of grass in a 20-foot circle and don't really remember a whole lot about it other than, you know, just getting an ass whipping or something. But Lord have mercy, we used to go at it. And like I say, we did it on the side of the road, the side of the interstate. It didn't matter.
We've torn down rest areas, John. We go in a rest area in the bathroom, you know, and to take a whiz, and somebody, hey, you didn't finish that beer. There's still a couple of swigs. Yes, I did. And start. We'd tear down stalls. I mean, we were lucky we weren't arrested in the rest areas. It was a wild. Like Jimmy said, I still got my shirt. Terry Allen claims he's got his shirt. He showed me a picture of it, so he does. But like Jimmy said, we had to have two shirts because they get ripped off. They get some blood stain and beer stain. You couldn't wear them for a week, you know, our wives would try to wash them and everything. But Jimmy's house wasn't too far from mine. And Jimmy got the idea one time. Jimmy, tell the sister about you raising quails. And, you know, John, I'm a Native American. You only raise animals to eat. You know, you'll raise them wild animals as domestic pets. Right, Jimmy?
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes because of the payoffs in Florida, I felt like eating a couple of quails. But I mean, you know, I had them just in case. But they were pets, and I had these quails. Man, I'd feed these quails, and I had them in little pens, and I don't know how many quails I had, but I had a lot. I had 100 quails or something, you know. And we come back from a trip. And Jack was doing being Jack, you know, and I was about three, you know, sheets in the wind type of thing. And he got to me, him and Jerry too. Jerry was part of it. Jerry would throw in his 2 cents just to make, he was like the extra coating just in case, a little bit of extra icing if you needed it, so to speak. But they had me feeling so bad about having them quails that I was almost in tears because I had those quails in a cage and I didn't understand, but I was just being bamboozled by these guys because they had me feeling so bad that we pull up to the house and I can't describe it. It's such an emotional moment. I bust out of the car and staggered and stumbled into the backyard, and Jack and Jerry's right behind me telling me, you know, Jim, you need to set yourself free and set them free and all this kind of stuff. They were preaching to me like dadgum Pat Robertson or somebody else or somebody. It was awful. And they had me feeling so bad. I was back there. I was throwing cages up in the air and talking to the birds and telling them to fly free. Got up the next morning. I asked my wife, where's the birds? What happened to the birds? Because I didn't remember, you know, letting them all free. But she said, oh, no, you let them all free last night, you know, out there. Things turned over everywhere. But, yeah, the birds, they were free. Yeah, Jack and Jerry had me feeling so bad I had to set the birds free.
Jerry, do you not feel bad about that at all? This man raised those quails.
Yeah, but he was raising them for immoral purposes. You know, he was selling them on the black market to all the restaurants around.
Those Florida days, the Grand Apollo, he could drink some beer too. He could put some beer down. But Terry Allen, wasn't he the one that came along and he was the one that put us all to shame almost? Am I wrong about that?
No, Terry Allen, man, that guy could put some beer away. And I say, John, El Grand Apollo was a young man from Cuba. He couldn't hardly speak a word of English. But, you know, he was a really handsome young man. And here in Florida, there's a big Latino population, a big Cuban population, you know, so we built him into a star. And this guy, I mean, he drew the female audience into our buildings. And I mean, he was such a nice young man when we got him, you know. And
Yeah, that's changed.
By the time he left Florida, you know, we didn't know what happened to him.
I don't think he knew either.
Well, he ended up buying a Cuban grocery store down on South Beach, and I think had it for like 10, 15 years in South Beach, exploded, and he sold it. And He bought a big rig, Jimmy. He bought a big rig and become a trucker.
But he could drink some beer, couldn't he?
He had that. He was only 18, 19 years old, but he could drink that beer. But you're right, Terry Allen. I mean, Terry and Barry, those two guys, they would go at it. And Barry Windham, I mean, you know him, John. I mean, you travel the world with Barry. You know what kind of drinker he was. Well, you just tenfold what Barry could consume, and that's what Magnum TA could consume. And that's the reason he got the shirt.
Barry could drink all night and drink as much as you wanted. And he Barry looked like he was the same. I've never seen anything like it. Barry was one of the best beer drinkers I've ever seen.
Magnum TA, he was right up. He could do it. In fact, you know what happened about it's had to be maybe, let's see, 9 to 2. It had to be like 27 years ago. Terry Allen and I still are very good friends, and he lives in Charlotte too. And we talk, you know, once a week or so. And I said, Terry, we started talking about that Leader of the Pack shirt, and he says, yeah, I got it at home. Now this is like I said, it's about 21. It was right after I retired in 92 or 93 or something like that. Before I did my real long stint up there in WWE, that was 7 days I was up there. But that's another story. I told Terry, I said, Terry, I want to challenge you for that shirt. Now, you know, we were a lot older then when I said those words than we were with the young days when we really fought for that shirt. And really, when somebody challenged you, the shit was on, you know. But he says, okay. So we had a date, time. Okay, I'll have everything ready. Come to my house. We're going to sit down. My wife said, oh, boy, here we go. You know, it's not her first rodeo either by watching us. So I remember we sat down in my house, and I got to about six or seven beers, and I fell down the stairs. Because I don't know about anybody else, but I mean, I can't nowhere close. If there's going to be a tournament, all I need is a six pack and I'm going to be fine. I don't need a case or anything like that. And I fell down the stairs, and that called the end of the tournament there. So Terry still has his shirt. I think he won with, I think, seven beers, and I fell down the stairs at six. So I said, Terry, it's hell getting old, you know, because You remember, Jerry, one of my deals was I would take a six pack and chug it one after the other, just one after the other, and then get a jump. That was my forte.
You remember know, that? I forgot all about that, but that was Jimmy's start. I mean, he would grab a six pack before any of us would have a chance. He'd be through with that six pack by the time, and we're all pretty salty beer drinkers. I mean, that ride was loaded with it made Budweiser stock rise like crazy that year.
But yes.
We were all pretty good, but Jimmy would get so far ahead of us that, you know, we had really struggled to catch up. And it rules with, you know, if you disputed somebody because, you know, somebody would throw a beer can in a pile, do you hear that clink? You could hear if there was like two swallows left in it, or we had it down to a science, right? We knew when somebody was cheating. That's when the challenge flag would come out. That's when we'd pull over on the side of the road, get out, and settle our differences right there.
Yeah, Lord have mercy.
Did you survive that? Stop when you're, because you guys were famous in Florida. I mean, everybody's watched Florida Championship Wrestling. Everybody here stopped and realized, hey, wait a minute, these are the guys we watch on television fighting on the side of the road.
I don't think anybody, when they seen that going on, I don't think anybody would stop. You wouldn't do you no good to stop. You might as well just keep on going.
Jimmy, they had a Barney Fife cop down in Lake Wells. This is coming back from Palm Beach. You get on that old Highway 60, John, and there's nothing but horse farms and prairie fields out there and rattlesnakes and alligators. But there's a little town about halfway between Yeehaw Junction and Tampa called Lake Wells. They had a little Barney Fife sheriff there that loved wrestling. And he knew on Monday nights around 2 o'clock in the morning, there'd be carloads of wrestlers passing through his little town. So he would make it a habit of pulling guys over. Well, Jack had bought a brand new Lincoln Bell Blast, a really nice car. And so Patterson and Louis Donofrio was in front of us. And so they were speeding. And so the cop pulls Pat and Louis over. And they start BSing, and Pat said, "Hey, I know you like the guys." He said, "Do you like the old Briscoe brothers?" And he said, "Man, I love the Briscoe brothers." Well, they're right behind me. And so, so of course, the cop said, "Oh, great. Well, you guys go on." And Pat described what kind of car. And now here's us. We probably got Jimmy with us or somebody with us. We have Don Morocco with us. So we have probably, I don't think Jimmy was with us that night, but Morocco was with us, like Brian Blair. We had every type of illegal contraband you could possibly have in that car. And so we're going along, and that's back when moonroofs were first coming out and on cars, you know, you hit that button and all of a sudden you call them sunroofs up there where you're from, but down here they're too hot in the daytime, so they're moonroofs. And we used them to moon each other out of also. So here comes the cop. We see that red light going. And so the windows go down. It looks like we're sending smoke signals at Custer's Last Stand, you know, smoke bellowing out of the windows and through the rooftop there. And that cop gets out of his car. And before we can get out, back in those days, you could get out of the car and meet the cop, you know, but nowadays you can't. But so anyway, the cop's lights flash, and so we pull over, and the windows go down. A cop just gets out of his car, and he comes running up to our window. Jack's driving, of course, and "Oh, Jack Briscoe, oh, man, I've been wanting to meet you, blah, blah. Can I have your autograph?" "Yeah, Abram is all right, you got to drive safely." Didn't look in the car, didn't say a word about the smell or nothing, just let it go. So the cops, you know, back in those days, we were policeman friendly because we did so much community service, right, Jimmy? Eddie Graham always had us doing community service here for the police department. Now I understand why he had us doing all that stuff.
Yeah, because otherwise he'd lose all his talent and his territory and everything. That reminds me of a story too. Michael and I was going from Atlanta to maybe it was Augusta or something like that. Anyway, it was on the interstate, and we was in Patty's Mercedes, and we was hauling butt. And we got pulled over, but we had the titles at the time. So, and I always kept my wallet in the trunk if I was driving, so I'd have to go in the trunk. And it would also have a bunch of pictures and T-shirts and stuff like that, Freebird stuff. So we get pulled over, and I tell the policeman my stuff's in the trunk. And I open the trunk, and he's a wrestling fan, but he sees the shirt, and he goes, "Oh, that's one of them shirts." And I says, "Yeah, you want one, you know?" And I mean, while I'm getting my driver's license, I give him a T-shirt. And he says, "Well, is that the belts right there?" I said, "Yeah, that's the belts right there." Yeah. I said, "Turn around, I'll put it on you, you know?" And he turned around, and I snapped that belt on him, and he was parading around the car, strutting around with that on the side of the Interstate 20 or whatever that is down there. And then had a good time, told me, "Don't worry about a driver's license." He says, "Just y'all be careful." He says, "My buddy's up there at mile marker, like 127 or something. And he's in the woods on the left-hand side running radar." He said, "Just slow down before you get there." We said, "Okay." So in the meantime, these cars have been passing us because we've been pulled over, obviously. Well, we get back in the car. This guy's got a T-shirt, autograph, wore the belt, you know, everything we can give him, we gave him. And, we get back in that Mercedes, and we hit about 120 miles an hour. We're blowing past cars, and they're probably wondering, "What in the world? These guys, we just seen them with the blue lights and the policemen have them out by the side of the road. Now they're doing 120 miles an hour. We're flying." We get about 3 miles from that mile mark, and we go, "Back it on down." The brother got out of his car over in the woods. He's out of his car, and he's like, he got his hand there beeping, and he's waving at us as we go by, and we wave back at him. We slide on by, and then once we got by him, we bing, along we went. But I mean, you could get away with it back then. I don't know if you could do it now.
Hey, Jimmy, you mentioned WWE and your week-long tenure in WWE. I don't know if Jerry was on the plane, but I was on the plane when you were flying with Vince and Kevin Dunn and the whole crew between cities, where we were flying. I've never seen hardly Vince McMahon so enraptured by a story. You're sitting there telling story after story about the days of Crockett and flying private. Vince is just sitting there just laughing, drinking his wine, just listening. You're in your zone, man. And I'm sitting there, I walk out of the place, I said, that man has a job here for life. And the next thing I know, you're gone.
And you know, I probably could have had one, you know, but I'm not saying nothing that ain't the true, but you know, I don't think, but I just wasn't, it wasn't, I just couldn't do what I had to do in order to get to, you know, to fill all the pegs to play cards. You know, I mean, I tell you what really got to me. The worst thing was, you know, I was with the NetJets anyway. I'll mention their name one time with them at the time. And I actually went to them and asked them if I could have a leave of absence to go pursue that. And they said, yeah, that's fine. You know, because it's the greatest company in the world, by the way. And they let me go up there and I went up there and I was used to working for them. And, you know, they take good care of their pilots, you know. I was in that writing room, you know, where all the guys were. And I can't remember what bunch of guys were around. But it came lunchtime and we all got up like. And we like ducks and walked up to the cafeteria in a line and got our food and then came back down. And I did that a couple of times. And I thought just the fact that I have to do this duck walk to go eat and come back, and, you know, and then I thought, hey, that ain't gonna work too good with me, you know. And I was comparing the lifestyle I had with the greatest aviation company in the world to that lifestyle. And I think I was done with that part. And I just couldn't get back. It's not that I had nothing against the business or I didn't love the business, but the fact that I just couldn't put myself out there, you know, in that atmosphere, I just couldn't. As much as I love the business, and I do, obviously, you know, but
it was just funny to us because Jerry knows when Vince gets one of the older guys around and they're telling stories, that's when Vince just lights up. He just loves the business. And that night, he was just sitting there just enjoying you and Michael telling stories. And it was so funny because I said, man, it's great to have Jimmy around. They go, no, he's gone. And I said, what do you mean he's gone? He said, he quit. He couldn't handle it. He wants to go back to flying planes. I said, we understand.
And still there, you know, even with my yearly schedule that, you know, I pick whatever line I want. My seniority there, 20 years is pretty good. I only fly 4 months out of the year. So the rest of the time is I'm off. And that's hard for somebody to match, you know, and regardless, you know, WWE is a great company, but, you know, ain't nobody like Mr. B, you know,
I don't want to skip around, but I did hear a rumor about you one time with the Freebirds ordering room service and the room service showing up and all you guys are buck naked in bed together.
Yeah. Michael and I were in bed together. It was either Lafayette or Lake Charles or one of them Cajun countries anyway. And we had went out the night before. We went out every night, but this night before we went out to this bar. It was the University of Louisiana, whatever it is. It was their bar. It was like the Tiger
Prowl or something like that.
Yeah, like Tiger Room or Tiger Zone or
Tigerland.
Tigerland. So Mike Hayes and I in Tigerland out there in the middle of the night. And I'm drinking and carrying on. And then he gets the bright idea that he tell you the story about him getting up on the bar.
I've heard about him moonwalking, right?
Yeah. So we're drinking, and he jumps up on the bar And Jay, I don't know if you heard this one or the people that are listening, and I'm sure they haven't heard it, but well, maybe they did, but that Michael Hayes starts moonwalking on the bar. Well, he's knocking drinks over and stuff, but it don't matter. We just put more drinks back up there, and they knew that. But the thing was, over the bar, they had these Louisiana fans that they just didn't spin like this, you know, like at the Olive Garden. These things were turning some RPMs. I mean, they were blowing some air. These fans were rotating at an enormous rate of speed. And Michael Hayes moonwalked right into one of them. It hit him in the back of the head. The blades exploded everywhere. Hayes, he was so good because he didn't sell it too much. I think he was out on his feet, but he staggered. He didn't fall off the bar, but that fan blade hit him. And I told the guy next to me right before it happened, I go, watch what's getting ready to happen to him. You know, about that time,
so, boom. So you didn't warn him. But
no,
you
I didn't warn him.
I knew he was going to do it.
I said, watch this, because this guy's going he's gonna moonwalk right into this fan. And boy, he did, brother. And then he dropped down to one knee and did like an Elvis thing, you know. But and then he kind of crawled off in the bar and, you know, stayed over in the corner for a little while until he came to. But I had never seen anybody get hit in the head with a fan that was going around that fast. It was just amazing.
Amazing that you didn't want to warn him.
Oh, no, you couldn't. That would be no fun at all. See, that just ruined everything. You know, because you know this was really getting ready to be a show, and it was too when that fan hit him in the back of the head. You'll never see that again. I don't know where you'd see something like that.
So, how did the Freebirds end up in bed naked together ordering room service?
Oh yeah, that's right. So in the meantime, so then when that closed down, we end up going to this after hours place out in the swamp somewhere, and Lord only knows. But so we end up. We end up waking up the next morning. We're in the same bed, king size bed, butt naked, laying there with a massive hangover, and we're really, really hungry. So we order room service. So we order everything on the menu, then whatever we wanted plus everything else. So the guy comes to the door. I said, so I got, because we're both laying there, you know, like trying to come to, you know, after like a fight at the OK Corral kind of thing. And I said, I'll get it. So I just go over and unlatch the door and just turn around and go back. And, you know, about halfway back, he comes in with the table, you know, on the wheels with all the fuddy-duddy stuff all over it, because this is a nice hotel and a nice big room. Hell, I think it had two bedrooms or something, but we're in the same bed because that's where we passed out. That's where it was. And so I get up in bed. So we're both propped up in bed like this. And the guy's looking at us, and he don't know where to look at us, look at the floor, pick his nose or do something. And I said, no, go ahead. You know, and he says, you want me to serve you? You know, yeah. So he serves us. And we're in there butt naked eating scrambled eggs and grits and sausage and boudin or whatever the heck we get our hands on, you know. But yeah, we were flat naked.
We were in Nashville one time, and Buddy was backstage, and Buddy was we served him up all kinds of booze. He was riding back to Atlanta with Michael, so we get Buddy hammered. I mean, hammered. Michael was so mad at us the next day. He goes, thanks for getting Buddy drunk before the trip. He goes, you're as bad as Jimmy Garvin. He said, Jimmy Garvin was the one guy who could make Buddy mad.
Oh, yeah, I could fire Buddy up pretty fast. There was another time I have to – it just come to my mind. If I don't mention it, I'll forget it. Michael and I were in Honolulu. His wife and my wife and – we went to the North Shore for the day and rented us some snorkel equipment and stuff like that. And the girls were on the beach, and it was nice, not too wavy or anything. And there was a pretty big reef out there a ways. So I told Hayes, I says, come on, let's put snorkels on and we'll go snorkel out there and look around. Well, he never really was into snorkeling much anyway. I could just tell that he wasn't exactly the snorkeling kind of guy, but he's out there snorkeling around and was looking at stuff. And I noticed that all of a sudden we're quite a ways out, at least a football field from the shore, but there's this real nice reef. It was deep, and then the reef was only about maybe a 2 feet deep or something, enough where you could just float and look around. Everything's pretty close to you. And I noticed that I floated up one like this, one time. Then I was real calm. But then the next time I kind of floated up a little bit higher, and I thought, oh, shit, what? Something's happening, So I look up, and waves, they come in threes. You heard that before? Like big waves, they come in threes and fours in situations like that. Well, I look up, and there's a freaking huge wave coming. You can see it way out there just coming. So I'm trying to get Hayes. I'm trying to say, Hayes, there's a big wave coming. And he's not paying attention or nothing. Well, I had just went across this cavity in this reef. It looked like a 50-gallon drum just like hollowed out inside this reef. And it's about 4 or 5 feet deep. And I remembered where it was at. So I finally get a hold of him, and I tell him, I go, pointing at this wave. And he don't know where to shit or go blind. So he's like looking at the wave, looking at me, and I'm saying, come on, because there's a hole here we can get in, but you got to come now. Well, he didn't make it. So I dove down in this hole and held onto the sides, and this huge wave billowed across the top of my head. You can imagine how that looks. And after it passed, I come up out of that hole in the reef. All I seen was Hayes' ass and elbows going in the air. His blonde hair is everywhere, and then the wave goes on, and he staggers around. He's bleeding because it drug him across the reef, so he's got blood coming out of him, and his snorkel, his mask is around his neck, and his snot's coming out of his nose, and he's a wreck, right? And I look this way, and there's another one coming. And I said, come on, get in over here in this hole, And he was trying to get that way. And I looked that way and I looked that way. And I figured, well, he ain't going to make it. So I'm going back in the hole. Well, I went back in the hole. That wave hit him again. And to this day, if you have him on or talk to him, which might happen in the future or something, ask him the time I tried to save him in Hanama Bay, and then just stand back and listen, because he'll have a lot to say about me supposedly trying to save him in Hanama Bay. When we got to shore, both of us was pretty well cut up, but he was a mess. I've never seen anything like it in my life. But to this day, he swears he'll cuss me up and down for trying to kill him or not saving him and all this kind of stuff.
Michael always says that expression. I don't know whether it's shit or go blind. So we're in creative meeting one time. Michael is one of the most creative guys I've ever been around. I love Michael. He's a freaking genius when it comes to laying stuff out. He's amazing. You got to be around him to understand it. So he's in there one day with a bunch of the young writers, and he goes, I don't know whether to shit or go blind. And one of the writers says, why would you do either? And Michael looked at me and goes, you're stupid. that makes Freebird sense.
Freebird
logic. Hey, and wait a minute. You blame me for being stiff. At least I was green and had an excuse. Michael Hayes, when he was at his best, was stiff. He could that stupid left hand anywhere from the knee to the top of the head. The only thing you knew for certain was he's going to potato you.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But that was my Michael Hayes story. Remember to ask him now. You might have to write it down later or something. But ask him the time I tried to save him when we were snorkeling.
I'll ask him. He almost came on the show today. He said he's going to come on in the future, so hopefully we get him. But I want to ask before we quit. I want to ask you about the flying. First, I got to ask you about teaching Bam Bam Gordy to fly.
Yeah, that was. I tell you what, that because I started flying so young at 17, I started flying, and then I got my license and instructor rating and all that kind of stuff. So I could teach, and I don't want to take full credit for teaching them, but I helped them a lot. I helped them along a lot. At the time I had a 401, later on I had a 401. At that time I didn't. So he's flying, he's learning how to fly, but I didn't want to be, I couldn't be at the time really teaching him anyway. So I hooked him up with a teacher, Steve Horvath, and Steve got him going. And on the side, on the road, I would help him with the bookwork part or explain to him the concept of different things, systems and aeronautical knowledge and stuff like that, charts and whatever. I'd spend a lot of time with him in the hotels helping him in that way. But I come to find out that he was taxiing one time. I wasn't there or with him, but I guess he got distracted, which he could get distracted, and he hit a fuel truck. He sure did. He hit a fuel truck, and thank goodness they didn't blow up. You know, I mean, he wasn't.
Was the props going, Jimmy? Was the plane going?
Oh, yeah. It was a single. He was in a single engine. It was 182, and taxiing, and just didn't. I don't know. I wasn't there, so all I know is he hit the truck and bent the wing, and didn't penetrate the tanker that was holding all that fuel. Thank goodness. But yeah, he did hit the fuel truck. But he kind of quit flying after that. And then there was another flying story that I had rented a twin engine, and I don't know if it was like a Duchess or whatever. It would hold like six, seven people, and so it was a buddy Roberts, Sunshine, the Boris Zukov, a couple other guys. And we're taking off out of somewhere, and buddy says, "Jim, what's that coming out of the left wing tip, the top of the wing?" And I looked over there, and shit, there's oil just streaming out of this left engine. I mean, because of the pressure differential and everything, it's just sucking it out of the, it's just sucking the oil right out of the engine. And then Zumhoff says, What this car over here on the right engine, and I look over there, and that oil is getting sucked out of the right engine. Now I don't know if the line guy hated the wrestling or hated us or whatever, but then again, I should have checked the caps too. So I'll put the blame on myself. But we were losing enormous amounts of oil out of both engines. And I told everybody, I said, just because everybody's kind of freaking out, if you can imagine, because it ain't going to be long because they'll quit. So I said, okay, we'll go back and all that. Boris Zukov, he was that big ball. I don't know if you guys knew him, but big head. And his head was glowing like a, I don't even know how, what, it was big and red though, but his blood.
Like a watermelon.
Pressure, yeah, it was almost had like a red light on his head. It was glowing so bad. Buddy Roberts, he couldn't open up many bottles fast enough and drink them. I think he drank at least 15 before we returned to the field and landed. We landed okay, and nothing really happened. But it was just there was the few seconds of not very pleasant experience, you know, with oil being sucked out of both engines at the same time. But it was all good.
Before I let you go, I do want to ask you a story that I heard from the Freebird, Michael Hayes. He said, ask about the time you were tagging with Jake Roberts against Afa and Sika when Jake accidentally knocked Afa's eye out of socket.
I'll tell you what, that is an amazing – that was a Jackson, Mississippi. Calkin was the promoter. I can't remember his first name. It don't even matter. But it was Jake and I against Alpha and Sika, as you said. And they didn't like Jake anyway, because Grizzly Smith and Jake, and they just didn't like Jake and his the way he at the time and stuff. That there was some problems, but it was serious enough that they didn't mind telling anybody that wanted to know and some that didn't, that they didn't like Jake. So I used to go camping with them all the time, and because I had that 32-foot prowler and a pickup truck, I'd go from state park to state park in Louisiana when they had us driving all over hell and half Georgia. But we used to camp together. So I was real close with Alpha and Sika. And so I'm in the ring with them. Boom, boom, boom. We're doing our thing. They do anything for me in the world, you know. And I tag Jake in, and Jake comes in. They're not that friendly with him in the ring. He's having to work a little bit for what they're giving him. He's having to work a little bit for it. As compared to me, it was just like being served to me, so to speak. And in the meantime, while this was going on, Jake, for whatever reason, accidentally potatoed Sika or Alpha in the side of the eye here, and popped his eyeball out onto his cheek. Well, he hit him. And Alpha shook his head like this, and the eyeball kind of swung a little bit. And Jake kind of screamed almost, you know, when he seen it. And then Alpha, you know, he just let out this Samoan kind of like scream. And I take my glass off. and Jake is in, just don't even know what to do. And so Alpha takes his hand and he goes like this, his hand, and he puts his eyeball back in his head, but it's looking over here, but it's, at least it's in his head. Well, Jake turns around to tag me. Well, I took a walk. I mean, there was no doubt about that. I wasn't getting tagged. I went and argued with the fans over here in G section or something, you know. There wasn't none of this. No, I wasn't tagging me. So they snatched him. And Lord, by the time I turned around from escaping the tag, I turned around. They was giving him an ass whipping like I ain't never seen. Two Samoans. The Samoan came out of him anyway. But I mean, they whipped his ass, and they whipped it so bad that they would let him almost. I was going to take the tag because I felt sorry for him. So after the initial blow up, I thought they're going to kill him. You know, I need to take the tag. They're going to kill him. They would almost let him get to the tag, and then they would just snatch him, you know, and then pull him back, you know, and then whip his ass again. Bam, 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 bam. I'm like, just tag me. I'll come in and leave you. And then they'd let him go a little bit. He'd be time to get the tag, and nah, pull him back. You know, it was an awful ass whipping. It was an awful ass whipping.
So you mentioned Sunshine before we go. You had two Sunshines and two Preciouses, right?
Yeah. I, let's see. I had.
Did you run out of names?
No. No. I don't know how that. I don't know what happened there. I think I only had one Sunshine, didn't I?
I thought you had Sunshine 1 and then Sunshine 2, and then Sunshine 2 took over 1 when you had the deal with David Von Erich, which is one of the most famous things from the old Dallas Sportatorium, where you ended up having to work on his ranch for a day. That was one of the best clips of all time.
Yeah, that's I'm proud to have that in the can. You know, that was pretty historical stuff, and having David to work with and stuff like that was great. Switching gears again because that's what we've kind of been doing. But I got to tell you, in my career, and again, I was so blessed, and I'm so blessed and grateful to have had such a great career and to have met some really wonderful people. And Jack Briscoe is at the top of the list in my heart and in my memories, and Jerry and the times that we had. And I can still see Jack smile all it takes me is a second. Just think of Jack. I can hear his laugh. I can hear him call me Jimmy and tell me something, you know, something crazy. Do you remember that time, Jerry, you guys had me at the Sportatorium? And you got me down there because you guys must have been bored and you wanted something to do. So you called me down there. They, John, that was horrible. They were ribbing all the time. You just never knew. So I was in an angle with somebody, and they were going to teach me if a guy has a finish, but there's how you get out of it.
Was it Roop? Bob Roop?
It might have been, but it was like, you guys were going to teach me how to get out of this finish that he had or somebody had. So I said, okay, they're going to, I came down there and we all got in the ring, me and Jack and Jerry, and we're messing around a little bit. They're showing me some stuff because I was a young kid too. I mean, it was still maybe mid late 70s or something. But anyway, they had me go up on the top rope and do like this dive, and then, but they said that was part of the how you start out to fix this to escape this finish. Just when he goes to throw you in the ropes or something, you climb up the ropes, you go through and climb up the ropes and come off and give him some kind of big splash thing like this.
I think it was Joe LaDuke you were wrestling against, and it was the big bear hug.
The bear hug thing, yeah. And y'all were going to show me how to get out of it. So I go up there and I dive off like this here, and Jack's down there and he moves. And it was the simplest thing of moving. Like, I smashed into the mat like, baked potato. And I remember Jack and Jerry laugh about that. It's just one of those things in my memory. But I had wonderful memories with you guys down in Florida. That was a special time in wrestling, really.
Things were just so wonderful, and the crew that we had was just we were all friends. And Steve Kern, Dick Slater, Dickie had just got in.
Born Jr.
It was just loaded with the guys. You Barry was just coming in, starting. Magnum was just starting. So we had a young group of guys that we all got together. We all kind of lived close together too. And back in those days, John, we'd actually have a Sunday off for a while. And then we'd all come over to my house or Jack's house to the lake. And I remember one time Jimmy used to be a heavy smoker. And Eddie Graham liked for his baby faces to dress up really nice. Remember, Jimmy?
Yeah.
So Jimmy come out, we're on my dock. I just happened to have that day off. So Jimmy was making a road trip, and he is either going to pick up Jack or meet somebody up the road here a little bit. So he come by to stop at my house and get some Odessa orange.
Yeah.
So we walked out on the
legendary Odessa orange.
Let me tell you. Yeah.
It was famous, wasn't it, Jimmy?
Yes, it was.
So anyway, we're walking out on the dock to kind of look at the fish and kind of get refreshed. And Jimmy was all dressed up to make a road trip. Jimmy is smoking a pack of Marlboro cigarettes. And, I'm real anal about my yard. So anyway, Jimmy takes the end of that cigarette, but not thinking, he flips it in the damn lake. I look at him, I said, Jimmy, you got two choices. Either get that cigarette butt out of my lake or I'm going to throw your ass in at it. And he said, I'm all dressed up. I said, hey, man, this is country. Nobody cares. Go down to your skivvies. No, and so I started to take him. He'd wait, I'll do it. He finally stripped down to his skivvies and jumped in the lake. And Jimmy had a head of hair, like a big old afro out to here at that time, about 3 foot wide. He come up, that hair was up, draped all over him and everything. I threw him a towel, got him out of the water, but he got the cigarette butt out of my lake, and he never threw another cigarette butt at my lake again.
That's right. You didn't have to tell me twice. That's the same lake that I took the skidoo out at the middle of the night. Remember we rode that skidoo in the middle of the night, shit-faced?
Yeah, the jet ski, and Joe LaDuke from there with the alligators out there.
With alligators,
yeah. In the middle of the night, jet ski, John.
Yeah.
I had first jet ski on my lake, and people hated me that first year I had that jet ski. Because, we're wrestlers. Our fun starts at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning when everybody's in bed and sleep. So we come off a road trip. We wanted to unwind a little bit. We go head out to the lake, crank that damn jet ski up. All the damn walls and all the lights coming on all over the damn lake. And be big three. Who's going to say anything to big 300-pound Joe LaDuke? And he's out there running around. He said, "Guys, I think I had a log out there." That wasn't no log, Joe. That was a damn gator. Boy, he threw that jet ski aside, ran up on the shore, and never got back in again.
Didn't Jack, wasn't he going to go, was it Jack that was going to go dive off his dock, and at the last minute, he saw that gator down there?
Yeah, over here with that. And a Blair, when we threw them, we used to get you guys out on those canoes and throw oranges at you, and you'd try to swat them with the paddle and turn the canoes over all the time.
Yeah. But Lord, we had some good times. We had a lot of good fun.
Hey, Jimmy, this has been great. You know, on behalf of John, you know, Michael Hayes, he wants equal time. He said he'd like to come on with you. So somewhere down the line when we can line up that busy executive to come on the show, and maybe we can figure out how to get four of us on this screen. We'd like you to come back and then to really dive into the Freebird era of Jimmy Garvin, because you've had such a wonderful career as Jimmy Garvin, Gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, Freebird Jimmy Garvin. I mean, just all down the line. That's the reason you're in the Hall of Fame, because of your career. We would love to spend another hour or so with you and Michael on this show.
I appreciate it, and I thank you so much, both of you guys, John, Jerry. I mean, my blessings to both of you and your families, and I'm so grateful, and I'd be more than happy to do that. I think that'd be a lot of fun. I definitely know it would be a lot of fun. We got to get Hayes on here, because, I can push his buttons, too, sometimes, like I do with Buddy, like I used to do with Buddy, but it would be a lot of fun. He's got some good stories, too. And it was just a real pleasure talking to you guys. So I look forward to it. My schedule's open right now, so I'm pretty much can do whatever I need to do. So just let me know, and I'll be more than happy to come back on if we can make it happen.
Well, it's great. Been a terrific honor, Jimmy. It really has been. This has been a huge thrill. I mean that very sincerely. When I was standing in the ring there in the sport tournament, saw the Freebirds come down. It's just one of the thrills of my life. And, I've been fortunate to work with a lot of great talent. But you guys are certainly at the top of the list.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you, Jerry. And God bless you guys, huh?